When you think about that, the last couple of weeks, we've been looking at a passage in John chapter 10, a simple verse, John 10:10. Listen to what it says. I want to read it real quick to you. I want to talk about it a little bit, give you a little bit of background as we continue on, as we finish up this Sunday. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you what, as I was going over notes and everything and praying early this morning, I just really sensed that God really not only wants to speak to us, but he wants to get down in the heart of some of the things that we deal with day in and day out this morning. But let me read this verse. John 10:10 says, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy." Listen to what Jesus says conversely that he came to do. "I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." When Jesus said, what did Jesus intend for us to have that he would call life? The first couple of weeks, the first week, as we looked at this passage, give you a little context, what had happened here was Jesus had healed a man that had been born blind. As a matter of fact, they were coming along and his disciples pointed to the guy, and apparently this guy was known, well known enough that they knew who he was. He had come out to beg because he had no way of making a living for himself. He was an adult by now, and the only way that he had was to beg, to ask people to give him something. And he came to Jesus and his disciples came by, and his disciples point to him. It says this in John chapter 9, verse 1. It says, they saw a man blind from birth. It says, the disciples asked him this question. It says, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" And Jesus said, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned that he was born blind." But Jesus said this statement, "But this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life." Well, the occasion in which he healed this guy was on the Sabbath. The chief priests and the Pharisees, who were already at odds with Jesus, they already didn't like him. They already didn't like what he represented. They didn't like the fact that he hung around people that were of lower character. They didn't like the fact that he hung around tax collectors and sinners. They didn't like the fact that he hung around drunks and prostitutes. They didn't like the fact that he offered grace to them, that he offered forgiveness, that he offered a new life to them, even though their past didn't warrant them to have the opportunity to get it. He healed this man blind on the Sabbath, so they tried to accuse him. They drug the blind man in. They questioned him for a while, trying to find out about Jesus. They were looking for a way to accuse Jesus, is what they were doing. And when they questioned him, eventually he got tired of the question, and he said, "Look, you're asking me these questions. You're the one that's supposed to know. You're the religious authorities. You're the chief priest, and yet you don't know who this guy is? He's going around doing miracles. He is changing lives, and you don't even know who he is." And of course, by that, they got mad, and they threw him out. They kicked him out of church, basically. And when he left, when they finally kicked him out, Jesus went and found him, it says in the end of John chapter 9, and says, do you believe in the Son of Man? And the guy said, "Tell me so that I may believe in him." He said, "The guy that's talking to you is he." And he said, "Lord, I believe." And it says he began to worship Jesus there. So because he healed this guy, Jesus took the analogy of healing this guy that was born blind, turned around and said, "Listen to this." He said, "I tell you, the truth, the man who does not enter the sheep pen by the gate but climbs in by some other way is a thief and a robber." He starts talking about how this analogy of the sheep and the shepherd, how he was the good shepherd. Well, the Pharisees and the chief priests heard him talking about this. They were listening to this conversation, and of course, they realized he was talking about them, that they were the false shepherds, that they were the thieves, the robbers. They were the ones who were not taking care of God's sheep, who were not leading them according to God. And he comes down to this point to where in this verse that I just read in verse 10, where he says, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." In the first week, we saw that the life that Jesus intends for you and for I is to live free. Live free from the bondage of sin and our past, but also to live free from religious duty and practice. It's not about how good we can be. It's not about how bad we are. Someone said it this way: there is no one so bad that the grace of God cannot save them. There is no one so good that the grace of God need not save them. In other words, there's no one good enough and there's no one bad enough that doesn't need the grace of God. God came to set us free from sin and bondage and free from from religious duty and practice. And then we saw last week, Lord have mercy, if you were here last week, I'm telling you what, the Holy Spirit of God was here last week in the worship. And as we opened up the Word, talking about how Jesus intend for us to have a life right now, how we can get chained down by our past. We can get chained down by those things that have taken place in our life and even some of those things we've done in our past. And we can let those dominate us and control us and shackle us. But also we can, on the same on the other side of that coin, we can be paralyzed by the fear of the future, about what's going to take place. And we saw through this passage last week how Jesus intends for us to live this life free from the prison of our past and free from the fear of our future, to live right now, that He intends for us to live today. Understanding we cannot change from the past, we cannot change the past, but we can learn from it. Understanding we have no control over the future, but He does. He is in charge. And because of that, we can be set free from both the past and the future to live right now in this moment, the life that God intends for us. But I want to talk to you this morning about two misconceptions about the life that Christ offers. Two misconceptions that we deal with every day. Two misconceptions that are in the church every single day. When it comes to this life that He says, He said, I've come that they may have life. Well, if He came to give us life, then we need to understand what that life is. But there's two misconceptions about the life that Jesus offers. The first misconception is, God just wants to take things from me. And I'll translate that. God doesn't want me to have any fun. God doesn't want me to have fun. God just wants to take things from me. He just wants me to let go of things. He just wants me to just take things out of my life that I'm holding on to. Listen to what Jesus said again. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. The only one that wants to take things from you is the thief. He wants to take your joy. He wants to take your peace. He wants to take your marriage. If you have children, He wants to take your kids. He wants to take everything that God wants to give you, He wants to take away. Jesus said, that's the thief that takes away. I'm not the thief. I have come to give. I have come to add to your life, not to take away. The misconception is that if we give our life to Jesus, if I give Him control, then He's going to want to just take all these things out of my life, and my life is not going to be any fun anymore. My life is not going to be enjoyable anymore. That's the thing. Many people are only concerned about what they may have to give up to follow Christ. We're only concerned about those things we have to give up. One of the greatest lies that we believe is that God is holding out on us. I mean, it is. It's the greatest lie that we believe, that somehow God is holding out on us. Somehow He just wants to take things from us so we don't enjoy life anymore. Do you know what? That's the original fear that dates all the way back to the Garden of Eden. It's the very first fear. It's the very first lie in the Bible. It's the very first deception. And who do we know that wants to lie and steal from us? The thief. Jesus referred to him as the thief. You go all the way back to Genesis chapter 3. Listen to what it says in chapter 3 and verse 4 and 5. And you got to get the picture here. This is the Garden of Eden. The serpent comes along and is speaking to Eve. And Eve is standing there and she's having this debate with the serpent, and said the serpent was more crafty than all the other creatures in the garden. Listen to what it says. The serpent told the woman, "You won't die. God knows that the moment you eat from that tree, you'll see what's really going on. You'll be just like God, knowing everything, ranging all the way from good to evil." You know what Satan was telling Eve? He says, "Won't you take of that fruit?" And she said, "No, God said don't eat of that fruit, that in the day I eat of it, that we would die." He said, "God didn't surely say that." He said, "You won't die." What was he saying? He was saying, "Don't believe God. God's holding out on you, Eve. He wants to keep you from having all that you could have. He wants you to not know what He knows." And he says, "Look, when you eat of that, you'll see what's really going on." Boy, did she. Didn't he? Didn't Adam and Eve really see what was going on? I mean, they had the perfect opportunity. And if Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, in a perfect environment, in a right relationship with God, could make that choice to believe the lie that God is holding out on you. See, most people, they live their life with this conception. If I really truly just kind of hand my life and hand the reins of my life and the steering wheel of my life over to God, He's just going to take some things out of my life that I really enjoy. He's just going to take something from me. When the whole reality is that he is keeping us, he is protecting us. I mean, what Satan was saying to Eve is God is holding out on you. He's keeping something good from you. And it's a lie. It's a lie. The only thing God took from me, let me tell you something. God took some things from me. When I gave my life to him, January 24th, 1990, he took some things from me. He took my sin. He took my shame. He took my regret. He took my guilt. He took my punishment. He took my embarrassment. Does anybody recognize this? He took my emptiness. He took my loneliness. He took my filth. He took my junk. He took my anger. He took my bitterness. He took, just like this blind man, he took my blindness. When he saved me, when he changed me, when I finally said, you know what? I'm tired of doing things this way. I'm tired of traveling this way and having control of my life. I've made a mess of it. God, I am giving control over to you. If you can do anything with it, you can have it. And I'm telling you, that moment, God took all those things from me that were holding me back, that were holding me down. The only thing he took from me was the stuff I would have gladly given up anyway. The lie. The misconception is that God's holding out on us. That if I give him control, then he's going to take some things from my life. The second misconception is, and this is the one we really deal with, especially in the United States, because we have it in many ways. We have a far better life than most of the rest of this planet does. My life, here it is. This is the one we battle. My life only needs a few adjustments to be okay, to be right with God. That's a misconception. We think that my life, that our lives only needs a few tweaks, a few minor adjustments. If I could just get this job and I could live in this city and I could have this home and I could be married to this person and my kids could act this way, if I could just make a few minor tweaks and adjustments, just like we're trying, man, I'm showing my age, just like we're trying to adjust the dial on the radio to get the signal perfect. We feel like we're right on track. We're almost there. We just about have it right, and I just need a few adjustments in my life, and my life will be right. My life will be on track. My life will be right with God, and I will be okay. And listen to what, I'm telling you what, do you think the blind man felt that way? Do you think he went along through his life, man, if I could just have a little more light in my house and a little bit more candles, if I could only go outside in the daytime when the sun was out and it wasn't cloudy, if I could just get some good glasses, that would help. I could see a little better. I could see just a little bit. He was blind. He didn't need an adjustment. He didn't need a little tweak. He didn't need a little fix, a little correction here. What did he need? He needed somebody that could open his eyes so he could finally see, so he would no longer be blind. He needed that major transformation. He needed that miracle. He needed that overhaul. He needed that complete change. The blind man, I promise you, he didn't feel this way, but I'll tell you who did. Those chief priests, those Pharisees, the religious practiced people. They thought that a man could follow their prescription of righteousness and be right with God. Just follow these rules. Do all of these things. Follow all this plan that we have laid out. You'll be right with God and your life will be okay. And you know what? You and I feel that same way many times. If I could just make a few little tweaks in here, get the adjustments here, everything will be in focus. Finally, I'll get my life on track. And it's a lie. It's a misconception. It's wrong. The problem was that they were as blind spiritually as that man was physically. And they didn't see. But you know what? Their spiritual blindness was even worse than his physical blindness. You know why? Because it was deliberate. It was deliberate. You say, what are you talking about? Listen to what Jesus told him in John, in the previous chapter, in chapter 9, verse 41. Jesus said, he's talking to the Pharisees, he's talking to the chief priests. He said, if you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains. That's where many people are in their life every single day. They think if they can just go to church, just make a few adjustments in their life, do a few more moral things, not mess up too bad, that somehow their life will be okay and that it'll be on track. Just a little here, little there, put a little spice on it, everything's fine, it tastes good, and everything's okay in my life. And it's just wrong. Just like these chief priests and Pharisees, just like the blind man, we need that major transformation. We need that change. Here's the problem. We would rather make a few small adjustments in our life and just feel like we're okay rather than have God make a radical transformation in our life. You know what? It's a whole lot easier just to make a few adjustments, to make everyone else think it's okay and to make us think it's okay. That's a whole lot easier than to truly submit our life to God and say, God, here it is. You do with it what you want. You change me how you want. The life that God intends for us, the misconception is we only need a few adjustments and it'll be okay. When the reality is, let me tell you something. Jesus did not come to this earth to die and die on a cross to make our bad life good. He did not come to make our good life better or even the best. Jesus came to raise our dead bodies to new life. There's a big difference. We think Jesus came and see, he sets a good example. He was a good teacher. We just follow his way and everything will be okay. The problem with that is he came to take my dead body and raise it to new life. He didn't come to change me, transform me just by tweaks here and tweaks there and making me a good moral person. He came because I was spiritually dead, spiritually blind. As a matter of fact, the book of Ephesians said this in chapter 2, verse 1. It says, as for you, Paul said, hey, as for you, you were dead in transgressions and sins. Now, there's a big difference between needing a few tweaks and adjustments and being dead. I went to the hospital this past week because I had a couple of weird things happen that I'd never experienced before in my life. So I thought, you know what, there's something wrong here. I'm not a smart man, but I'm smart enough to know that this is probably something bad. So I'll go to the emergency room. Man, I'm telling you, they did all kinds of tests. They did all kinds of checks. They checked everything they could find and see and looked and really couldn't give me a definitive explanation. But they did say, overall, you're in pretty good health. And I thought, well, that's reassuring. But the problem with that is this. Hey, there's a big difference between me going to the hospital and getting a few little checks and tweaks and finding out some things and being dead. And Paul said, look, you were dead in your transgressions and sins. Listen to verse 4 and 5. But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us what? Alive with Christ. Even when we were dead in transgressions, it is by grace you have been saved. What was Paul saying? He said, because of sin, because of transgression, because we had disobeyed God, we were rebellious against God, we were spiritually dead. We may be physically alive, but spiritually we are dead. He said, Christ didn't come to just give you a good example, to be a good person to follow, to be a good teacher, to be a good philosopher. He came to die so that you might live, so that you, being dead, might have his life. There's a big difference. A philosopher said this once, the problem with life is that it almost makes sense. It almost makes sense. It's not that life makes total sense, because we know it doesn't. There's some things we just can't explain. There's some things we look at and go, that doesn't make any sense. Or it's not that it makes total nonsense, because we can figure some things out on our own. The problem is that it almost makes sense. And that thought leads us to believe that only a few small adjustments are necessary in our lives for it to be okay, for our world to be right. Man, that's the misconception. That is wrong. That is totally opposite of what the Bible tells us. The distance that you and I see as the small gap between us and our lives being okay is really a canyon that's impassable. Think about it. You think, if I just get this right, and this right. But the problem is that will never make us right with God. And that small gap that we see is just a little bit, tweaks and adjustments, is an impassable canyon for you and for me. It's impassable. Most people live their lives completely content with the thought that something is missing rather than to allow Christ to make the major overhaul that is needed to restore them to real life, the life that God intends. Why? Why do we do this? Because we just don't realize what we're missing. We really don't. We don't realize what we're really missing. Jesus in the book of Revelation challenged, there were seven churches in Asia. Most of them are in the region of Turkey. And he challenged one particular church, a church at Laodicea. he was confronting them on some things. He was basically saying, look, you need, you're doing a couple of things. He had these seven churches, and he's told several of them. He said, look, you're doing some things right, but I'm telling you, you're way off track. He told the church at Ephesus, you lost your first love. But he got to this one church, and he didn't say one good thing about them. He didn't say one good thing. To the other churches, he said, look, you're doing this right, but you need to work on this. You're doing this okay, but I have a problem with this. Each one, but when he got to this one church at Laodicea, he didn't have one good thing to say to that church. Listen to what he says in Revelation chapter 3, verse 15. He says, I know you inside and out, and find little to my liking. You're not cold, you're not hot. Far better to be either cold or hot. You're stale, you're stagnant. You make me want to vomit. Man, that's harsh. You brag, I'm rich. I've got it made. I need nothing from anyone. Oblivious that in fact you're a pitiful, blind beggar, threadbare and homeless. Here's what I want you to do. Buy your gold from me, gold that's been through the refiner's fire. Then you'll be rich. Buy your clothes from me, clothes designed in heaven. You've gone around half naked long enough. Buy medicine for your eyes from me so that you can see, really see. We walk around blind every day to the fact that God has a life intended for you and for me that is far beyond, far above anything we could ever imagine for ourselves. We live in total blindness to it, and what's worse is many times we're willful and deliberate in being blind to it. We would rather make a few minor adjustments and make everything look okay than to allow Jesus to do a major overhaul and transformation in our life, because we know that is diving all the way in. So what is this full life that Jesus intends for us? I want to talk about it very briefly. What is the full life that Jesus intends? He says, I have come that you might have life and have it to the full. First of all, the full life that Jesus intends is intimacy with God himself. Intimacy with God himself. Not with a preacher, not with someone who's spiritual, not with another Christian, although we have that. But at the same time, what you and I need is intimacy with God himself. That's part of the full life that Jesus intends. That's what's missing. We don't have that intimate relationship with God. Listen to what he says in John 10:3 in this passage. He's talking about a shepherd. He's talking about the sheep. It says the shepherd, he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. You know what that dictates? You know what that denotes? When a shepherd calls them by name, that means he knows every one of those sheep intimately. When you call somebody by name, especially like if it's your kids, your wife, your husband, someone you care about, you know them by name, whether it's a friend, you call them by name. Why? Because you know them intimately. He goes on in this analogy of the shepherd and the sheep in verse 14. He says, I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep, and my sheep know me. That's intimacy. It's a beautiful picture of the intimacy between Jesus and his followers, especially in contrast with a life of just religious duty, of just going through church motions, of just being a good church person. The difference is, he desires intimacy with you. And he says, here is intimacy with me. I'm telling you what, the one thing that escapes me day in and day out as I live my life as a Christian is the fact that I can go sometimes hours on end and never once acknowledge that I have a relationship with God. Then I can go through all of the motions. I can get busy with my life, and I'm going through everything so quickly, but I don't experience that intimacy with God, and I'm missing out. It's like on a hot day. You know, some of you may have done yard work or something like that yesterday. Maybe you did some things you just wanted to play hard. You just went out and said, hey, it's Memorial Day weekend. I'm going to relax. I'm going to do some things. I'm going to have some fun. You went out. You got hot and you got sweaty as the heat began to build yesterday. You come in, or maybe you stopped somewhere and got a Coke or some Gatorade or some tea or some water. And it would be like, man, taking just a sip of that water and say, man, that's refreshing. I need some more of that. And your glass is empty. You're standing there with a whole pitcher and you go, man, I am so thirsty. And there's a pitcher sitting right there and you just refuse to drink it. I mean, that's the picture of us living our lives empty. But the picture of living a life full is that intimacy with God. He said, I know you by name. I'm glad God knew me by name. You know what? God knows your name. He knows your address. He knows your phone number. He knows your email address. He knows everything about you. He knows everything about you intimately. He knows you, I mean, when others would not want to know you. He knows things about you that no one else knows. He knows you inside and out because he loves you. He knows who you are, and yet he still loves you. He knows who I am, yet he still loves me. That's the full life that he intends for us. John, later on in John's gospel, Jesus is talking to his disciples, and listen to what he says in John 15:15. He says, I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I have called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. Isn't that beautiful? He says, look, you call me master, and that's right, I am master. I am God. I am the Lord. He said, but I don't just call you a servant or a slave. He said, I call you a friend. He said, because I'll tell you what's going on. I'll tell you what I'm up to. I'm telling you what, the full life that Jesus intends is intimacy with him. The full life that Jesus intends, secondly, is a life of direction. Listen to what he says in John 10:4 again. It says, when he has brought out all his own, when the shepherd has brought out all of his own, he goes on ahead of them. And his sheep follow him because they know his voice. I love that. He goes on ahead of them. I'm so glad that God doesn't just say, that's the direction I want you to go. Now you just go. You know what he does? He goes on ahead of us. You know, before you came in here and sat here this morning, God was here. He showed up. Not just because there was some of us in here setting up the lights, the sound, the video, practicing, rehearsing, setting up G-Kids in the nursery and all those things and guest services. He was here because he intended to meet with you here this morning. I'm telling you, the full life that Jesus intends is one that he will lead you. It's a life of direction. You know, it's one thing for you to stop and say, you know what, I'm trying to find this place. Can you tell me how to get there? And somebody say, well, you go down this way, and then you take a left on this street, and you go down about 2 miles, and you'll see this big tree, and you turn right, and it's kind of split in the middle, and you just turn right there, and you go about 2 more miles, and you just turn another left, and then another left, and you're sitting there going, what? But it's quite another thing for somebody to say, you know what, rather than me trying to give you direction, how about I just lead you there? Boy, there's a big difference. That's the life that God intends for you. You see, religion says, do this, go this place, do this, do this. God says, I have already done those things for you. You couldn't do those things for yourself. I live that life for you. Follow me. Follow you. Follow me with your life. Hand me control over your life. Follow me. You know, you see these bumper stickers says, God is my co-pilot. They got the wrong seat. They need to just get out and get back in one of the passenger departments and say, God is my pilot, co-pilot, navigator, everything else. He's the plane. I'm telling you, he's the air I'm flying in. He is the pressure in the cabin. I mean, he is everything. Jesus, the life that he intends for us, the full life, is a life of direction. It's one of hope. It's one of purpose. Many people live day after day with no purpose, no sense of direction for their life, no meaning for their life. But this is exact opposite of the full life that Jesus created us to live. It's the exact opposite. He created you to have a life of purpose, a life of direction, a life of meaning. And I'm telling you what, you may feel like I did at some point in my life and feel like I had wasted my life and realized, came to that conclusion that I have wasted all of these years. And I'm telling you what, Jesus said, you know what? You give me your life. You give me control. You let me take it. And I will give you a sense of purpose, direction, meaning, hope. I will give all these things. That is the life, the full life that Jesus intends for you and for me. I'm telling you what, he gives us a life of intimacy with God. He gives us a life of direction. But I want you to know, lastly, he gives us a life, one that is overflowing. Listen to John 10:10 again. He says, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. I love that word full. If you have King James, it says abundantly. I've come that they may have life and have it abundantly. The Greek word here, full or abundant, is the word perissos. Perissos. See if this, and I'm going to describe this word for you. See if this word's descriptions match your life today. Listen to this description. See if it matches your life. Here's the description and the definition for this Greek word, full or abundant. More than necessary. Super added. Supremely something more. Much more than all. Extraordinary. Surpassing. Uncommon preeminence, more remarkable, more excellent, over and above. Does that match your life? Is that the life that you're living today? Let me tell you something. If that's not the life you're living today, let me remind you of something. According to this word and according to Jesus' own statement, that's the life He has intended for you. That's the life He created you to live. Not one of mediocrity. Not one of getting by. Not one of the ordinary. Not one of the plain. But the supreme, more excellent, over and above, uncommon, extraordinary, surpassing, supremely, something more, much more than all, more than is necessary, super added. That's the life He has intended for you. Don't ever let anyone tell you differently. I'm not talking about God providing you a 5,000 square foot house and a $100,000 car to drive, maybe like a $200,000 car, I don't know. But I mean, I'm not talking about the physical, material things. I'm not talking about just the prestige and honor from other people. I'm talking about the full life that Jesus intends. I'm not talking about health, wealth, and prosperity. I'm talking about that in spite of your circumstances, in spite of everything that's going on around you, that you can have a supremely surpassing, excellent, more excellent, above and beyond all, over and above kind of life. That is what He intends for you to live. That is what He wants you to live right now. He wants you to live free, we saw the first week. Last week we saw He wants you to live now. But I'm telling you this morning, with everything that is within me and according to the Word of God, He wants you to live full. Because the contrast was what? The thief that wants to rob from you. The thief that wants to take away from you. The thief that wants to destroy you and destroy what you have. The thief that wants to kill you. He says, in contrast, I want to add to your life. I want to add to the fullness of your life. And here's the key. Here's the key of it all. Refuse, listen to me clearly, refuse to believe this full life is for someone else. I said that last week, but it's the key to that full life. You see, we are duped into believing that's only for the religious elite. That's for the super spiritual. And I'm telling you, refuse this morning to believe that that full life that Jesus talks about right here is for someone else. It is for you. It is for today. It is for right now. Listen to John chapter 9, verse 6. This is where He heals the man. Having said this, this is after He told him this man wasn't born blind because of his sin or his parents' sin. This is because God wants to get glory out of his life. Listen to what He says. Having said this, He spit on the ground. Jesus made some mud with the saliva and put it on the man's eyes. Listen very carefully to verse 7. Go, He told the man, wash in the pool of Siloam. And that word Siloam means sent. Listen to this last statement. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. What if that man would have said, you know what? I've been blind all my life. It's never going to change. This is the way my life is always going to be. If he convinced himself of that, he would have stayed there and never received his sight. What had to take place? He had to do exactly what Jesus told him to do and said, look, the life that I intend for you is not this life. But if you'll go, do as I said. Follow me. Follow my direction. Put your faith and trust in me. I've got something better in store for you. And it said he went, he did exactly what Jesus said. And when he washed his eyes, it said he went home seeing. There's a big difference. Some of you could go home today a totally different person than what you walked in this morning. Jesus is saying, follow me. Give me your life. Give me control. You don't realize what's at stake. You don't realize what he has in store. You think it's just a life of religious practice, of just going to church all the time. That's not what it is. It's a life of intimacy with God. It's a life above and beyond anything you could imagine. It's a life that has been set free. It's a life of direction and purpose, one that is overflowing. And we sit day after day, just like the blind man. Even worse, we've got the saliva. We've got the mud, the touch of Jesus. And we just won't go do what he said. It's laying like there. It's like a starving man with a feast in front of him. I want to share an Old Testament story. And I'll close with this. I didn't mean to be quite so long this morning. But I'm telling you what. I just truly believe that God wants to set some folks free this morning. In the Old Testament, a few hundred years before Jesus, there was a king over Israel. His name was Saul. Well, King Saul didn't really do what God told him to do. It seemed like every time God told Saul to go do something, he just went and did what he wanted to do instead. And eventually God said, you know what? You're not my king anymore. You're not my anointed one anymore. So he told Samuel, the priest, and it's in the book of Samuel. You can go read this for yourself. He told Samuel, he said, I want you to go anoint one of Jesse's sons as the king. So Samuel said, well, if Saul hears about this, he's going to kill me. So God said, I want you to do this. He said, I want you to go down and offer sacrifice, invite Jesse's sons. I'll point out the man that I have in store to be king, to succeed Saul. So Samuel the priest did exactly what God said. He went down, he told Jesse, he said, I invited Jesse and his sons to the priest. I love the story. It's a long story, but you follow with me. So eventually, guess who comes in? One of Jesse's sons, David, his youngest son. Samuel anointed David as the king, anointed him his. He said, that's my chosen one. He's the man. He's the one that is going to succeed Saul. Well, eventually, over time, there was this division because David became a great general. He became a great fighting man. So when you're a great, valiant warrior, guess what? People follow you. People will follow you. Men were following him. He was fighting on behalf of Saul most of his time. And Saul was jealous the whole time because he knew that God's anointing had been taken off of him. He knew that God no longer pursued him. So he got jealous. He wanted to try to kill David. He said, you know what? He said, I don't need this little punk, David. And he tried to kill him. Well, eventually Saul and his sons died. Well, one of Saul's sons named Jonathan was David's very best, closest friends. The Bible says their relationship was even closer than that between a man has with his wife. They were such strong brothers and such strong friends to the death. Well, a few years, obviously after Saul died and after his sons died, David became king. David succeeded king. As they were going around and these different territories were recognizing David as the king, David made this statement. He said, is there anyone left of the house of Saul? And of course, everybody back then, if you became king and you were of a different family, one of the things you did to make sure to secure your kingdom was you killed off all the descendants of that old king. That's one way to make sure none of those king's sons or grandsons comes back and says, hey, I'm the rightful heir to the throne. I'm a son. I'm a grandson. And it was called the purging. They did it for centuries. Matter of fact, they did it in the Middle Ages, too, and all through England and France's history. It was real common. If another family ascended to the throne, you killed off the other family. And it was called a purging. So as soon as David said, is there anyone left of the house of Saul? Everybody thought, okay, here it goes. He's going to start wiping out the family of Saul so none of them can come back and reclaim the throne from David. But David said this. He said, is there anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show kindness to them for Jonathan's sake? He wanted to show kindness to Saul's family because of his best friend Jonathan who had died that he loved so much and he cared so deeply for. Well, they searched and searched, and one of the servants in the palace came and said, there was a son. His name was Mephibosheth. Somebody ought to slap his parents. That's all I got to say. There's some names you just shouldn't name your kids. I'm sorry. I hear people's names and I go, God bless you. What were your parents smoking? You know, I mean, when they named you that. But here's the deal. They said, Jonathan had a son named Mephibosheth. When Saul and Jonathan got killed in battle, the servants kind of rushed the kids out to try to protect them so that the incoming king wouldn't kill them out. And they've been hiding Mephibosheth all this time. Problem is, when they were running out, they were in such a hurry that one of the servants fell across Mephibosheth and broke both of his legs, and he's crippled. And he has been since he was a kid. They went and searched him out. Well, you can imagine this took some time to progress, so some time has passed. Eventually, they brought Mephibosheth into David's presence. David looked at Mephibosheth, and of course Mephibosheth was just, you know, humble before the king. This is the king. He has the power of life and death over you. And he's thinking, okay, this guy's fixing to put me to death because I'm a descendant of Saul, a competitive king. And he says, I'm just a dead dog to you, King David. David looked at him and said, I want to restore all the lands that belong to your grandfather Saul. All of Saul's servants are going to serve you all the days of their life. He said, except for you, you're going to sit at my table like one of my sons, every day of your life from here on out. It's the most beautiful portrait of grace in the Old Testament, I think. We live our life every single day on table scraps like a dog. And God is offering us a feast at His table to live like one of His sons and daughters. And yet we choose to live in the gutter day in and day out, begging for scraps, blind. Only ours is many times intentional. We refuse to believe that this full life that Jesus is talking about is for us.